Our next story has set off a huge debate. Just what is the responsibility of a private living facility when it comes to providing life-saving care to the elderly people who choose to live there? Is a licensed nurse obligated to perform CPR, even if the facility in which she works says that is not their policy? And when should family members have the conversation about end-of-life care? All of these questions came into focus last week when 87-year-old Lorraine Bayless, the resident at a senior living center in Bakersfield, died after a staff member refused to perform CPR on Bayless. The incident unfolding on a recorded 911 call. That call prompted outrage across the nation.
Okay, that's not, we need to get CPR started. That's not enough, okay?
We can't do CPR.
Okay, then hand the phone to the passerby. If you can't do it, I need to hand it to the passerby. I'll have her do it. Or if you've got any citizens there, I'll have them.
No.
Anybody there can do CPR. Give them the phone, please. I understand if your facility is not willing to do that, give the phone to that passerby, that stranger that had that vent. This woman's not breathing enough. She's going to die if we don't get this started. Do you understand?
I understand.
Okay.
I am a nurse, but I cannot have our other senior citizens who don't know CPR.
I will instruct them in
there. We're in a dining room.
I will instruct them.
Is there anyone there who's willing?
Okay. I don't understand why you're not willing to help this patient.
I am.
Okay, great. Then I'll walk you through it all.
Well, some say it was the tone of the nurse's voice that upset them, combined with her refusal to perform CPR, despite the pleas from the dispatcher, the nurse citing the facility's policy as to the reason why she didn't perform CPR. Joining us for our discussion is Dr. Michael Nesko. He did his specialty training at the Harvard Center for Palliative Care, and he is now the medical director of St. Agnes Medical Center Hospice and Palliative Care and has been the chair of the Ethics Committee for the National Hospice and Palliative Care Organization. And joining us shortly will be Dr. Christopher Myers, director of the Kegley Institute of Ethics, professor of philosophy, CSU Bakersfield. Dr. Myers is also a member of the medical staff at Kern Medical Center, where he provides ethics consulting and education services. Dr. Nesko, thank you for joining us right now. And what I'd like to do is just to address some of the questions that have kind of lingered after this incident. Before we go into our discussion of end-of-life care, because I think that's really where this conversation is probably going now for many people after they've had a chance to really take a look at this incident and see what really happened. Now, despite the fact that the family of Lorraine Bayless doesn't fault the nurse's actions or the facility's actions at all, there has been this debate about if the nurse as a licensed medical professional, is required to perform CPR, no matter if the facility says there is a policy against it. Are nurses required in these kinds of incidents or required to take these kinds of measures no matter what?
Thank you, Juanita. Thank you for having me here. Very important issue. And regarding the nurse's obligation to treat, the nurse's obligation to treat is not as straightforward as one might think. The obligation to treat in an acute care facility, for example, where a patient is admitted or a visitor would be different from if a nurse was not on duty and on a sidewalk and at Disneyland, say. If you're not an acute facility and you see someone outside the window, is the nurse's obligation to leave the building and go out and perform CPR? Or are they even obligated to call 911? This professional practice standards actually aren't necessarily on nursing my area of expertise, but I can tell you it's not always very clear, and it's still not clear to me exactly in this situation was the patient where she actually coded. Was it in the acute side? Was it in a skilled side? What was the licensing of the building that she was in? Or was it in a common, unlicensed area? And all of these things come into play when you're talking about the nurse's legal or professional obligation. Clearly, there is another ethical perspective where you would want a nurse to, by default, try to resuscitate someone if they didn't know for certain that they didn't want to be resuscitated.
But I think, you know, you hit on a very valid point. At this point, they're still investigating. They're going to wrap up this investigation. But it was truly the 911 call and the constant playing of that 911 call that has sort of set this whole situation off. And now I think people are taking a step back. You know, they're conducting an investigation. And even you take a look at the facility itself. It issued a statement in the beginning that now it's sort of changed, first saying that it was the facility's practice to immediately call emergency medical personnel for assistance and wait with the individual needing the care until paramedics arrived. Then they follow up saying that Glenwood Gardens was conducting an internal investigation and kind of reviewing its policies involving emergency medical care. Is there anything wrong with this? And basically, just because of the 911 call, does this really and I'm sure you wouldn't know that, but when I'm thinking about really Warren and this kind of a large-scale investigation, and then politicians getting involved. And
it's always – I mean, it's rarely in the patient's interest when things get blown out of proportion like this. And I do think that this is out of proportion for the situation in the sense that we don't know what really went on. We know what we've heard through various media sources. I know that there are situations similar to this that happen, you know, every day in emergency rooms. It's an important issue, nevertheless, for us to work out. But what I've been on the other side of this, on the patient side, trying to protect patients' privacies as certain important individuals that the media are interested in will get a hold of a piece of a story that will go off in the wrong direction and isn't put in the context. And when we're making these decisions, context is everything. I don't know, for example, did that nurse know this patient personally? And had she told her the week before, don't you ever do CPR on me if I fall down? Had she had this kind of information and made a commitment to that person, and you know, when the lady who actually wasn't a patient, I'm sorry, she was a resident in a living facility, an independent living facility, I believe, which mm-hmm. wasn't licensed whatsoever. Had she signed when she agreed to live there, had she signed a contract that she understood that the staff would not do CPR, and if that case, was there actually an obligation by the staff to not do CPR. Maybe that's why she chose to live there, because people won't do CPR. I mean, we just don't know the backstory at all.
But, and I think that's probably part of the concern is that, like we said, the 911 call sort of set everything off, and people hadn't had a chance to really take a look at the entire situation before a lot of statements were made. Right now, I'd like to bring in Dr. Christopher Myers. He's the director of the Kegley Institute of Ethics and a professor of philosophy at CSU Bakersfield. Dr. Myers, what about all of the ethical questions kind of involved in this situation?
Good morning. Thanks for having me on. all of the ethical questions, boy. And what a place to start.
Not all of them, though, but
you want to focus that?
Yeah, well, why don't we narrow it down to the fact of the obligation of a nurse in a particular situation, the obligation of maybe the facility. There are some people, without knowing the full story, just assume that they should be obligated, even if there's a policy, when it comes to just pure ethical reasons, should have taken steps or certain measures to save this woman, not really knowing all of the information in the background.
Yeah, I was able to hear some of Dr. Nisko's comments, and I think they were right on that context is everything. It can't be the case that a healthcare professional, nurse or otherwise, has a duty to always provide CPR in all circumstances, as the example of somebody who has a clear advance directive demanding otherwise attests. I do think that healthcare professionals have an obligation to provide some medical care or some medical comfort in any circumstance in which somebody's in distress. And as Dr. Nisko was just indicating, we really don't know enough of what happened in that dining hall on that afternoon. It could be very well be that either the nurse on the phone provided Mrs. Bayless some loving assistance or made sure others did. Some kind of intervention was clearly appropriate. Whether that included CPR, I think the family's answer tells us exactly both what Ms. Bayless expected and what the family expected, which was that they should not have done that level of aggressive intervention.
And that's what the family is saying, and I've also read that that's what the resident, Mrs. Bayless, that's what she preferred as well. And then there had also been talk about the possibility, and again, all of these questions coming because people don't have all of the answers yet and haven't completed whatever investigation is ongoing, that even sometimes when you have an elderly patient at that age, you know, I think she was 86, 87, it's just not a matter of automatically saying you're going to perform CPR because of just for medical reasons for that patient because of their age.
There are any number of circumstances in which providing CPR will provide far more harm than good. And he has far more experience. I think it speaks that much
okay,
more directly.
Dr. Nisko, he's put you on the spot here.
Yeah, he certainly did. I hate to make too many assumptions on patients based on age alone. I had a patient in the hospital a little while back who was 87, and the treating physician said to me, we found a lung tumor, and I think we should just do palliative care in hospice because she's kind of old. And I went in and talked to her, and she told me that she was really upset that she was going to not be able to take her mother out for lunch.
No, and I don't
next week.
I don't think you so, can assume anymore because of age, but it really depended upon that patient and what that patient wanted.
Absolutely.
And from what we're hearing, even though there was no documentation, what we're hearing from the family and the people at the facility is that she knew going in. She picked that particular facility to live, knowing their policies.
Knowing their policy, that's right. So age clearly is one reason why we should have these discussions and talk with our loved ones and have post forms and advance directives. I'd say it's not the only story, and I don't think that's what Dr. Myers was implying either. Other cohort, some folks should have these, you know, as soon as they turn 21. A lot of folks should.
I mean, there are a lot of reasons, and it's not just for age. But before we go to break, I think one of the things, too, and I don't know if either one of you, this is your area of expertise, but I think it would be helpful if we could explain the difference between, you know, an independent living facility and an assisted living facility and a skilled nursing facility, because they're all different.
Well, I can do that.
Go right ahead, Dr.
All right,
Nisko.
Now, sure. So there are many facilities in the community to take care of those who need help. There's residential care for the elderly facilities, which are sort of board and care types. There's licenses that we provide when there's a need for skilled staff. An assisted living facility doesn't have anyone there who, as a rule, although they may have people come in from time to time, that can even pass medications. There's no RNs there. It doesn't provide any kind of skilled nursing. A skilled nursing facility, on the contrary, will have a licensed nurse there 24 hours who should be usually trained in CPR. There's a patient chart with orders. They're getting some sort of skilled care, like care for tracheostomies, physical therapy, care of feeding tubes, or intravenous medications. So that would be a skilled nursing facility. And I said the assisted living doesn't have that skilled nurses. And then there's the independent living, which is just an apartment.
and that's where she was. Yeah. It was like apartment living for her. But I think, you know, because of this incident and the, and you know, the follow-up discussion, is that when families sit down and they discuss, or even the residents themselves, they need to take a look and understand each of these facilities and talk to the people at the facilities about their policies and have a clear understanding if you're going to become a resident of any one of these kinds of facilities.
Oh, absolutely. Very important to make sure that you find a facility that matches the needs. There's not only different kinds, but different themes to facilities. Some like this, for example, who it sounds like made it very clear that we want to take care of folks who aren't really prepared, or we want to be able to respect the needs of those who don't want CPR if it comes time that they are dying, if they die here in our facility.
We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we are going to talk about end-of-life care and how basically it really doesn't matter the age, we should all be prepared. I'm Juanita Stevenson, and you're listening to Valley Edition.
Support for Valley Edition comes from Kaiser Permanente Fresno.
You're listening to a rebroadcast of Valley Edition. Welcome back. I'm Juanita Stevenson, and you're listening to Valley Edition. A lot has been said about the patient who died at a living care facility in Bakersfield after the nurse's refusal to perform CPR. But now, as more information is coming about the story, we do understand. We're going to play just a portion of the 911 call again. But what we will learn is all of this could have been prevented had a piece of paper been signed and put in place, and why it's important for all of us to take a look at that.
If you get anybody, any stranger that happens to walk by that's willing to help, okay. I understand if your boss is telling you you can't do it.
Yeah.
But if there's any, as a human being, I don't, you know, is there anybody that's willing to help this lady and not let her die?
Not at this time.
No, they won't touch her at all. I can't get them to touch her at all.
We have residents.
By now, we've all heard this 911 tape. But as time moves on, we're learning more and more about this incident. For instance, the family of Lorraine Bayless, the elderly woman who did pass away, do not fault the facility. They do not fault the nurse. They said that their loved one did not want any life-sustaining measures taken. She was aware of the facility's policies when she decided to move there. And after a week of this kind of discussion, what we hear is that the nurse and the facility and the family all could have been spared what they've had to go through if a piece of paper had been signed. Now, joining us with our discussion, we have Dr. Michael Nesko and also Dr. Christopher Myers. We're going to continue this conversation about the importance of letting your wishes be known as how you want to be cared for at the end of life. And right now, we're seeing part of that, because even though the family is saying, look, this is what our loved one wanted, from what I've been able to understand, there was no directive on file. So you really do have to do more than just say it.
Absolutely, Juanita. And we have some wonderful tools here in California to help people in this exact circumstance. We have an advanced directive for healthcare with a durable power of attorney for healthcare that people can download off the internet for free. And you can complete it and appoint a legal decision maker for yourself who speaks with all of the legal authority that you speak with to make decisions for yourself. And you don't need a lawyer to sign it. You just need two witnesses. I don't even need a notary, although you can have a notary do that. And that's how we appoint someone to speak for us when we become too ill to speak for ourselves. And there are versions of that available readily online. And then there's a second document which complements that, which is equally as important, called the POLST form, the Physician Order for Life-Sustaining Treatment, which is a nationwide initiative. And the most important thing about the POLST form is it is a legal DNR order that needs to be honored anywhere in California. And this was a new paradigm once this rolled out in California. Before then, you couldn't have a DNR order while you were walking on the sidewalk because you only had orders when you were in a skilled facility. But the health department and the legal codes in California now support that any healthcare provider should follow the directive of a POLST form when they see it as though it was an order. They don't have to verify the physician's license. They can follow it in good faith, and in doing so, will be completely protected from any civil, criminal, or professional liabilities as long as they're following that directive in good faith.
Dr. Myers, hopefully you can answer this particular question, because when we talk about the incident in Bakersfield, you know, we all don't have all the information, or we aren't privy to what's being investigated at this point. But in a situation where you have in this situation where the family is saying, you know, look, we know that this is what she wanted, but there is no document. Could it put people at risk, those who provide or don't provide the care?
Yeah, it probably can put people at risk either way. I, of course, can't speak to the legal requirements there. But so if you don't know, our social and medical standard is that you err on the side of providing intervention. Ironically, I happened to be in the facility on the day this happened, on a completely unrelated case, and I had with me Dr. Jennifer Black, who's one of our palliative care physicians in town. She asked me later, so what if I'd gone over to the dining hall to get a cup of coffee and saw Ms. Bayless in distress? She felt like, not knowing otherwise, she probably would have had to do some level of intervention. As we now know, she wasn't, in fact, in cardiac arrest. She'd had a stroke and was in respiratory distress. So CPR probably would not have provided her any assistance anyway. But just reinforcing Dr. Nisko's point, both those documents, the Advanced Healthcare Directive and the POLST, are absolutely the way to go. The problem is that sometimes they're not always available. She may have filled out a POLST form, but it's, as we regularly recommend, magneted to her refrigerator. And if it's not immediately available, it makes it really tough for folks to try to figure out what the default should be. I don't have a POLST form, but I do have an advanced directive. And I keep a little card in my wallet right next to my insurance card, first place they'll look, of course, indicating who my agents are and to call them immediately should the circumstances appropriately arise. And I think the far most important thing of all of these documents, the mantra of the POLST movement is it's all about the conversation. It's one thing to fill these things out. It's doesn't do a whole lot of good if you haven't talked with your family about it, if you haven't talked with your loved ones, the people who are likely going to be at your side in such circumstances. Those conversations can be really hard. I've done them very badly, and fortunately on a few occasions I've done them well. But in the end, it gets everybody to the place where they can feel comfortable saying, that's in fact what our mother wants or our father wants, and that's in fact what we will do in those circumstances.
Dr. Nesko, what he talked about is a difficult situation that many families are facing. And so how can you approach a family member? How can you kind of get into this conversation? Because from what I've read, a new survey just released last year said that only about 23% of Californians have put their end-of-life wishes in writing. So that means the majority of us haven't probably not have had that conversation. So, you know, how can we bring up that conversation?
You know, it is a difficult conversation to have with someone you love. It raises emotions, and the emotions sometimes are a barrier to going forward with the conversation that needs to take place. I find, and evidence shows, that many of the older generation is very much wanting to speak with their children about it. And it's actually the children themselves who have the hard time. Oh, well, Mom, don't say that. I don't want to talk about that, Mom. But, you know, it's a gift they're trying to give their adult children is, I don't want you to be in the position to have to decide for me and make a difficult decision. I want you to know what I want right now. And that's one of the best ways that or most useful ways that I phrase it when I'm talking with people about how to approach their son is, I'd like to give you a gift here. I want to tell you what I want so you're not in the position of having to make a difficult decision. You're just following what I want. Take the burden on myself instead of you. Oftentimes, it's easy to have a third party in the room, even with couples who've been together for 60 years or more. I find I have a particularly hard time talking about these issues. And when you have a person who's trained in these conversations present, sometimes the conversation can be easier if you're talking with your physician, your personal physician, or nurse practitioner, or other provider. But it's an important conversation. And once you get over the initial lump in your throat, you feel much better after having had it with the people that you love.
And we talk about, you know, this is a conversation that, you know, many adults are having with their, you know, parents who are now elderly. So that does make it difficult. But when it comes to end-of-life care, that anybody could be placed in that situation at any time. And so Can you have that conversation, or can you decide even with your children, you know, if this were to happen to you, you know, God forbid, if you were in an accident and this happened, you know, how do
excellent
you handle
question.
That?
That's an excellent question. And I think one of the points we try to make with the post form and DNR conversations or these sorts of conversations is the conversation really needs to be about values rather than specific treatments. The conversation should be, what makes life worth living to me? You know, what kind of suffering would I not want to have under any circumstance? These kinds of conversations can help guide your decision maker. In fact, you know, we often suggest we don't complete a post form or a DNR order unless someone's within the last year or two of life or we think that they might be, because there's so many different ways that people can die. You can have a heart attack, a stroke, and different people would want different treatments. And it's very hard to go there unless you've been there before to know exactly which treatment you would prefer. But if you are able to talk about your goals, about living independently, about being able to feed myself, being able to talk with my family and my loved ones, and at what point I wouldn't want heroic or aggressive medical measures to keep me from dying based on a certain function or other illness that I might have, then that helps guide the people you love, I find, a lot better than specific instructions about treatments or medications.
Okay.
And there are some great tools for helping to motivate that conversation. One is they're called the Go Wish Cards that walk you through your values, your goals in life, and it helps you to narrow down the things that are most important to you that can help everybody understand what's most important to you and use it to help fill out some of these forms. I'll give you a quick anecdote about doing it for our younger family members. I was having the conversation with my folks, my parents, in the process of filling out forms for them. And my stepson came in the room and said, geez, do you think my wife and I ought to have one of these? They were brand new parents. And I said, well, boy, you guys do a lot of driving. You're always tired when you're in the car. Now, God forbid you would have a car accident, but that's the circumstance in which it would be appropriate. As I was finishing that sentence, my daughter called, standing beside the freeway down by Magic Mountain, having just totaled her car in a terrible rainstorm, reinforcing just how quickly your life can change in dramatic ways and how important it is for all of us to be thinking about exactly the sorts of things that Dr. Nisko was just describing.
But as you mentioned, it truly is difficult for many people to have that kind of conversation. We mentioned earlier, too, not all of these documents, you don't need a lawyer, they don't have to be legal, is there any situation where you have to have a legal document?
There's Dribble Puff Attorney for Finances. Maybe you have to have one there, I'm not sure. But for our health directives, for our post forms, you need, for the advanced directive appointing a decision maker, you just need, two witnesses, at least one of which can't be a family member. The post form, you need a physician. It's documenting the physician and your conversation. So there's no lawyer in that process.
What is, Dr. Nisko, your concern when it comes to the aftermath of the incident in Bakersfield?
Well, I think that it sounds like the woman in Bakersfield, she had an episode that her wishes were followed. But we don't really know. There's a lot of hype and concern that comes when a situation like this happens, and it's a good opportunity for us to raise these questions again. But I would really hope that we as a people can redirect our concerns, because we don't know all the issues that happened in Bakersfield. Let's let the folks in Bakersfield who are family members of that patient deal with those issues, and let's look at ourselves and our own lives and our own loved ones and what we can do to help prevent getting over-treatment for ourselves or under-treatment. Let's have these conversations with our loved ones and use this as an opportunity for all of us to get advanced directives completed and post forms, if appropriate, completed for ourselves, or at least make sure that we're initiating these conversations.
Now, Dr. Myers, you are in Bakersfield. You mentioned you were at that facility that day. Being there and being in Bakersfield, do you think people have had the opportunity at this point to maybe step back and really look at this issue now that we've had a chance to learn more information?
We're certainly doing that. News media, of course, it's part of how news media do their job, is to focus on the dramatic and the immediate. The national news coverage of this story was unfortunately only focused on the dramatic and the immediate. That tape is so compelling, it would have been very hard for any news organization to ignore. But fortunately, in the local circumstances, they have the ability to continue the conversation in exactly the way we're doing this morning. You might have seen that Dr. Black and I had a couple of op-ed pieces in Sunday's Bakersfield Californian, again, with the opportunity to step back and reflect a little bit. The general sense I'm hearing throughout town is it's great to hear that there's much more to this story than we may have initially thought. It's great as a reminder of how important it is for all of us to have these conversations. And I think really importantly, we have to reinforce that by all accounts, this facility, Glenwood Gardens, is among the best in Kern County, very highly valued by the residents and the family. If they have a problem with their policy, this blanket no intervention under any circumstance, I have no doubt that they will appropriately reconsider it, as I hope our facilities all across the country.
Thank you for that. And Dr. Nisko, do you think doctors will start kind of initiate a conversation now with their patients or residents?
Excellent question, Juanita. I can tell you, the physicians often don't have time in a visit in a clinic to deal with a long conversation, which this often develops into. Physicians will see a lot of patients through the day, and these conversations are difficult and have a bit of an emotional burden on the physician themselves, and we're people, and we have a tendency to avoid emotionally distressing conversations just like everybody else. So bottom line is I wouldn't wait for your physician. Oftentimes the physician themselves is even wanting to perhaps go there or at least plant a seed, but they're hoping that you or your family will bring it up first that you're wanting to have that conversation. So please, if you'd like to have that talk with your doctor, don't hesitate to bring it up first.
I think this has been a great opportunity to remind people. It's not a topic a lot of people want to talk about, not a conversation. But now we're learning just how important it is to do that. And I would like to thank both of you for joining us this morning and then adding your comments to this. Dr. Michael Nesko, Program Director of the Hospice and Palliative Medicine Fellowship Program at UCF here in Fresno. And Dr. Christopher Myers, Director of the Kegley Institute of Ethics and a Professor of Philosophy at CSU Bakersfield. Thank you both for joining us this morning. We truly appreciate your time and your comments.
Thank you, Juanita.
Regarding
this. Thank you, Juanita.
Well, that is all for today's Valley Edition. You can hear audio archives and subscribe to our podcast online at kbpr.org. We welcome your comments and suggestions. You can email us at talk@kbpr.org. For audio engineer Marv Allen, production and operations manager Don Weaver, Valley Edition producer Ezra Romero, and executive producer Joe Moore, I'm Juanita Stevenson. This is Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation and the California Healthcare Foundation, supporting ideas and innovations to improve healthcare for all Californians. On the web at chcf.org.